Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Matt Taibbi, who's an investigative journalist, political writer, and author. He currently works at Rolling Stone, where he authors a column called Road Rage for the print edition and an additional weekly online column called The Low Post. He's probably best known for the coverage of the 2004 U.S. presidential election and for his former editorial positions at newspapers The Exile in Russia, The New York Press, and The Beast. Recently, Matt Taibbi has been a regular on Real Time with Bill Maher on HBO. And Matt Taibbi is also the author of several books, including Smells Like Dead Elephants, Dispatches from a Rotting Empire, Spanking the Donkey, Dispatches from the Dumb Season, and The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia, where he spent a number of years setting up a alternative newspaper. His new book, a bestseller, is called The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. We'll be joined by Kevin Phillips, who has a new book, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Kevin Phillips, of course, is a recovering Republican, if you will. He came up with Nixon's successful Southern strategy, which has essentially put the Republicans in control of the executive branch since Nixon, and also turned over the South to the Republicans. And of course, now the South is basically the bedrock of the Republican Party. And of course, we'll be talking about the subprime meltdown and where the economy is heading, and how all this bad money was enabled by Bush and Cheney. I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, who's an investigative journalist, political writer, and author. He currently works for Rolling Stone, where he authors a column called Road Rage for the print edition and an additional weekly online column called The Low Post. He's probably best known for his coverage of the 2004 U.S. presidential election and for former editorial positions at newspapers like The Exile, The New York Press, and The Beast. Recently, Matt Taibbi has been a regular contributor to Real Time with Bill Maher. You went undercover with John McCain's erstwhile preacher, right?
Well, it's not his preacher, but it's a guy whose support he's received, and they both John McCain and Pastor John Hagee have a relationship with AIPAC, which is the Israeli lobby, and that's how they sort of have a political relationship. But yeah, I was in Pastor Hagee's church for about 5 months last year, and for those of you who don't know a whole lot about this guy, he's what you call a Christian Zionist. He's an American Christian fundamentalist who believes that America has to support Israel because the end of the world is coming, and we need to be on the right side for the Battle of Armageddon. So it's sort of like an end times cult. And I was with that excellent crew of people for about 5 months.
And how did you get in to this kind of cult-like Christian cabal?
Well, there's nothing hard about getting into. They're just a regular old mega church in terms of their structure. If you've spent any time in the South, there are lots of these types of churches. And Pastor Hagee has a big presence on television, and people are welcome to come into the church at any time. It's just it's a matter of staying in there and going through the whole process of being baptized and going to priests and learning to speak in tongues. And they actually also taught us how to vomit demons out of our mouths and all kinds of fun stuff like that. And this is part of the whole indoctrination into the church, and I had to go through all of that.
So how do you fake speaking in tongues?
It's funny. They all have this way of speaking that is just so funny, and I couldn't really reproduce it. So I speak Russian, so instead of speaking in tongues, I just sang the lyrics to Russian rock tunes the entire time, and I guess that sounded demonic enough because that ended up getting me over for most of the time I was there. In fact, I ended up going through pretty much my entire repertoire of Russian songs while I was there, I mean, the Soviet national anthem, everything, but it worked.
So when all of these people gather and it's a kind of pornographic theology, really, that have an investment in the end of the world, to want our world to end in burning flesh so that their world can begin, do any of them really, are they prepared, since there's an obviously incredibly mercantile component to this kind of religiosity, any of them are prepared to leave the deeds to their houses and their cars?
No, you know, you don't see a whole lot of that kind of stuff where people are concretely planning for the rapture. Although I did know one person who had a kid who wasn't a believer. It was a couple who were in the church, and they had a son who was not a believer, but they were advising him to go into medicine because they believed that after the rapture there would be so many calamities that there would be plenty of work for an ER doctor. Because if, for those of you who don't know anything about what the rapture is, the belief is that all the believers will be taken up into heaven and that the rest of us will be left here on earth, and there will be lots of chaos and accidents and disease and that sort of thing. So they were advising their kid to go into medicine because they thought it would be an accident-rich environment that would be very profitable for him. So that was the only hint along those lines of anything like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you also need a canoe to paddle through the lake of blood.
Right, exactly.
I spoke to somebody who actually went on a tour of the Holy Land with Hagee's group, a British woman from the Daily Telegraph, and she said a lot of the people that are on the tour were sort of nerdy engineers who were out there in Megiddo, which is the biblical Armageddon, in this valley outside of Jerusalem. They were there, you know, measuring the lake for how and figuring out how many gallons of blood. It's an extremely lurid kind of notion. I've always been struck, though, Matt Taibbi, that the president of the United States, these people are his core support. And yet nobody in the media has been able to smoke Bush out on whether he shares the same belief system as his most loyal and diehard supporters. If indeed he does, then he's impeachable, because you cannot be the custodian of the nuclear arsenal and have an investment in the end of the world, nor could you be the custodian of the environment. So why do you think that he's never been smoked out on whether he believes this end time stuff?
You know, it's funny that hasn't been more of an issue. Obviously, John Hagee is a Texan, and he has a relationship with President Bush. He, particularly before Bush took office, Pastor Hagee was a prominent supporter, both financially and politically, of George Bush. And, you know, since Bush took office, they've had there have been numerous reports that Pastor Hagee's people are in regular contact with the White House, that they consult with that the White House consults with people like the people from this church on Middle East policy, and so there's definitely, you know, smoke and probably also fire in terms of they're having a real relationship with end timers. You know, that the Bush administration, the very people who are setting our foreign policy, have a real relationship with these people, and that's deeply, deeply disturbing. I mean, if you spend any time in this church at all, you know that they view things like the Iraq War as events that tend to confirm their belief system, that this is all moving us more and more towards a final conflict with what they believe, they call it Gog and Magog, which is, you know, these biblical forces in Revelation. They believe Gog and Magog is probably Russia and Iran, and they think that all of the events that have happened in the Middle East in the last decade or so are moving us further and further towards a confrontation with those forces. So, if President Bush has a relationship with these people, or John McCain does, it should be a really big issue, and it really isn't. And I don't have an explanation for that, except that we I think we're so used to Southern preachers being crazy in this country that we just have stopped being surprised by it when they pop up in the news. So that's the only thing I can say.
Right, because it is an amazing double standard that people like Hagee in the Reverend Wright, Obama's guy, all of these people are able to say the most lunatic things at the pulpit. And yet when somebody like Obama makes a rather thoughtful observation that a lot of poor white working class rural folk who feel bitter about their jobs being downsized and outsourced, they turn to guns and religion. And that's a terrible thing to say. But you can say the most insane stuff.
That would be about the most sane thing that you would hear in a in church for with somebody like Pastor Hagee. I mean, the stuff that I heard on a weekly basis was just absolutely mind-boggling. I think we're just used to it now. I think in this country, it's kind of a cliche that we have this whole class of people who are completely insane, and so we don't pay attention to them anymore. And we should, because they're a massive, massive voter demographic, and they have a huge influence on elections.
Right, obviously, fundamentalist religion and most of the evangelical movement has always been a front for right wing politics, but that doesn't mean there's not a lot of lunacy on the left as well, surely.
Well, no, of course there is. I get at this a little bit in my book, the odd thing about it is, particularly with this 9/11 truth movement, a lot of it's kind of taken on some of the characteristics of the Christian right. It's very, particularly with those conspiracy theorists, it's very messianic, and it really. Like the end timers and those sorts of cults, they really violently kind of disbelieve in the humanity of people who are outside of their group. So if you're not with them, you're really very much against them, and you're an enemy who has to be taken out. And that's that kind of conspiratorial paranoid politics is starting to pop up on both sides now.
Right. They had a gathering here in Los Angeles, and they wouldn't let the BBC cover it because I felt that the BBC apparently had said something that disagrees with their worldview.
Oh, really?
But you know, the bottom line with all this stuff is that a lot of these people actually think they're political activists. And it is the antithesis of activism to believe that the world is circumscribed by a cabal that sit in the back room and make these secretive decisions, and we're all helpless, and great events take place, and we're just pathetically manipulated by these unseen powers, whether they're Bilderbergs or trilateralists or whoever.
Right.
It basically reinforces despair. And it's a political message. It's absolutely suicidal because it basically says, let's just gaze at our navel and wonder who shot Bobby and who shot John and who shot Martin for the rest of our lives, while Bush and Cheney steal the store.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the big things I was trying to get at with this book. I mean, in this book, I spent a lot of time sort of focusing on congressional corruption and what the reality is of American politics. And you know, the reality is that there's a lot of incompetence and a lot of corruption, and it calls for people to start taking matters more into their own hands and really take more of an interest in policing their own political reality. But I think what what happens is that people are overwhelmed by the problems that we have in this country, and instead of dealing with them in a mature fashion, they prefer to take refuge in these theologies, whether it's the Christian right on one side or the 9/11 truth movement. And the 9/11 truth movement is in a way really a very reassuring escapist fantasy, the way you're talking about, because the fantasy is that someone is in charge, even if it's in an evil way. Someone is taking care of things on some level, and that means that we don't really have to do anything, it means that there isn't this crisis that we all have to start, acting.
Right.
And just as you say, it's in a weird kind of way, it's a very reassuring kind of fantasy. And I think a lot of people who believe in this stuff are guilty of just wanting to tune out and believe in this escapist thing.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, the author of The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. He spent a lot of time undercover, if you will, in the pews of the Reverend Hagee's megachurch down there in Texas. He's also looked at the symbiosis between the lunacy on the religious right and the lunacy on the so-called left of the, which I don't consider these people leftists. They just checked out essentially. But the so-called 9/11 truth movement, which is a huge waste of political energy, and a great kind of vortex of irrelevance. But there you have it. Just dealing with the real world for a moment, Matt, the real world is not looking too good in terms of McCain getting elected, and there's more than a lot of buzz out there now. We've had, for the longest time, Cy Hirsch has been reporting in the New Yorker about plans to attack Iran, but now there's some stuff coming out that's bringing this more and more into focus and making me consider that we're really in a serious straits here as we head towards November, perhaps even in October. There'll be an October surprise. Recently, the German foreign minister, the former foreign minister, Yoshi Fischer, who was in Israel for the 60th anniversary, was told by a number of senior Israelis that Bush, when he attended and spoke to the Knesset, gave the Israelis the green light to instigate an attack on Iran, which would then prompt the Iranians to retaliate against the United States' vulnerable targets in Iraq, and then that would be causus belli, and that we'd have another sort of Fox War where, you know, right. Operation Iranian Freedom.
Right.
And
right.
That would help this old codger who's pathetic and ridiculous, even though he gets good press. And maybe the only thing that will get him elected. I mean, what do you think of that scenario?
Well, certainly, I just got off a stretch of covering McCain. I followed him around last week, and as he took a swing through the South, and he does as a candidate, he's in a unique position of having to run against George Bush and Barack Obama at the same time. And he doesn't really have a whole lot politically going for him. But if there were to be a war with Iran, that would certainly benefit him, because that's the one thing that he actually has a clear, definitive position on. And whether or not you agree with that position or not is another matter. But he's very, very clear that he wants to do an awful lot about Iran, and he's trying to make the Iranian president the centerpiece of his campaign. He mentions Obama relatively little, but he talks about Iran almost constantly. And if there were to be, that kind of conflict, it would probably benefit his campaign. This is the thing that you can tell psychologically he's been holding ever since he left Vietnam. He always wanted to expand that war too. He talks a lot on the campaign trail about America's failure to bomb Russian ships during that war. And for him, our failure to attack Iran when Iran is probably supplying the IEDs and some other things in this war is almost the same thing. And so he wants to do this war, and if Bush starts it for him, I'd be sure he'd be happy for that development, certainly.
So you've been traveling on the trail, but prior to this, your work with Rolling Stone, you were in Russia a lot. It's one of the most amazing things that's happened in the Bush administration, and it's perhaps a consequence of how much Iraq has distracted and absorbed U.S. foreign policy. And it's obviously orphaned the Afghan situation. But the most important issue of all still is the U.S.-Russian relations, and they have absolutely been squandered in these last few years. And ironically, Russia is still the only country that can really do us harm. And here we are taunting Russia with a ballistic missile shield that doesn't work, that's designed for non-existent Iranian nuclear missiles. And this is driving the Russians up the twist. It's causing Putin to have to spend more money on defense. So in effect, the United States is increasing Russia's defense budget, which is a counterintuitive thing to do. And then you've got the real fact that the Kasbah and Crocus, that the early warning system on the Russian side is deteriorating. So here we are, you know, pushing the nuclear hair trigger back in front and center. And nobody's talking about it. And the Nunn Lugar account, which is meant to secure loose fissile material, Bush has been cutting money from it and marginalizing it. What do you think's going on here in the United States that is so counterintuitive? Because, as I say, you know, they've still got thousands of missiles that can be pointed at every our cities again, and we thought we got over that stuff, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Russia, the United States has badly mismanaged the relationship with Russia ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's just that it's doing it differently now that Bush has been in office, as opposed to, you know, the time that, during the Clinton years when we mismanaged that relationship in a different way by supporting a group of grossly corrupt Russian politicians who basically led the country to economic ruin for quite a long time. Yeah, obviously, our decision to tune out the Russians and to provoke them this has been going on ever since 9/11. You know, particularly when the United States talked about. I mean, I remember I was there. I was still living in Russia when this happened. When we were talking about how we were going to keep permanent bases in Uzbekistan, all the hardliners in Russia were immediately emboldened politically because it was further evidence that the United States was planning to encroach upon Russia's turf. I mean, this is something that had been, you know, had been a concern of Russians ever since the war in Kosovo. This constant fear that the United States is going to sort of crimp Russia's borders and its sphere of influence. And it's been all the things that you mentioned, and you know, the ballistic missile treaty and all of that, and the expansion of NATO and the courting of the Baltic states, and all of these developments have greatly increased the paranoia level of the Russian population, and also politically have really, really helped the hardliners. And to the extent where now we're moving Russia back into it's moving itself there without our help, but it's certainly not, our policies aren't helping prevent, you know, this consolidation of power by this kind of corrupt kleptocracy oligarchy that's in power now. I mean, ironically, it's funny that you bring that up this week, because the Russian government is in the process of shutting down my old newspaper, The Exile, this week. So I'm sort of seeing firsthand what's going on with the Russian government. It's certainly getting more and more draconian and repressive, and I think that the Bush administration shares a lot of blame for a lot of the things happening. Mm.
So, Matt Taibbi, back to your book, The Great Derangement, A Terrifying True Story of War, Politics, and Religion at the Twilight of the American Empire. I guess, you know, since you've covered the lunacy on the left and the lunacy on the right, it seems to me that that's really the great problem, for example, that Obama will have in this election is he's fighting this pervasive ignorance in the land. Not just this this sort of medieval world is flat, Noah's Ark, you know, the dinosaurs are on Noah's Ark. Not just that absurdity, but also that pernicious idea that somehow Obama is a stealth Muslim who took a pledge to Al Qaeda in a madrasa somewhere. You know, that as absurd as that is, apparently a lot of people in the land believe that. And I guess it's a product of our lack of education and et cetera. But I just wonder if indeed, you know, that we're sort of going back into a know-nothing era, because the one thing that Bush has done is he has encouraged, I think, this era of where belief is more important than fact. And one of the problems you have running against the Republican Party, that they don't believe in facts, they don't believe in data, is how do you make a reasoned argument with people who don't believe in data?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, you know, when I run into this all the time on the campaign trail. I mean, I'm always, whenever I interview people at Republican events and I ask them questions, the belief always comes before the facts do. They have a belief system. You know, people who support somebody like John McCain or Mitt Romney or somebody like that, they tend to have, they believe something and then they grope around for facts which support their thesis. I mean, the classic thing that you'll hear on the campaign trail is Barack Obama's a socialist. And I'll say, well, what do you mean? They'll say, well, I'm concerned about his socialist tendencies. And I'm like, well, can you name one? And they say, well, you know, I don't know, but I've heard people calling him a socialist on Rush Limbaugh or whatever it is. And it's you know, only secondarily will they actually bother to look something up. And even when they do come up with something, like, you know, they'll cite his healthcare program, you know, I might mention that, well, his healthcare program isn't actually publicly funded. It just would make it, you know, there would be some requirements for people to buy private health insurance. Well, that doesn't matter. It's still socialist. And it's a problem that we have. And I think that's one of the things I'm talking about in this book, is that because people no longer have faith in the mainstream news media and you know, in the government, they have tended to become reality shoppers. I mean, they look on the internet for their own information sources, and they trust their own groups, but they don't trust any common news sources anymore. And so you get this kind of pervasive ignorance, and it's definitely a problem. I mean, we're certainly a country that's very, very uninformed, and that's has a big influence on elections.
And I guess, in closing, that's a big part of what you've brought to the table here with The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. And we thank you for it.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Matt.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Matt Taibbi, he's a correspondent for Rolling Stone, the author of The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Kevin Phillips, who's an author and commentator who focuses on politics, economics, and history, formerly a Republican Party strategist. He held a senior position in the 1968 Nixon campaign and is largely credited with the Republican Southern strategy, which has propelled that party into power for most of the last four decades, particularly in control of the executive branch. Kevin Phillips is a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times and National Public Radio, and is a political analyst on PBS's Now with Bill Moyers. He is the author of 12 books, which include Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich, American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush, and American Theocracy, the Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Kevin Phillips' new book is Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Kevin Phillips, is the billion yet, or when will it come in, of the scope, depth and nature of this massive transfer of wealth that's taken place in the last 7+ years of the Bush administration?
Well, I think there's a massive transfer of wealth globally, not just within the United States. If anything, it's even more pronounced globally. You've had a huge amount of money created, liquidity. Debt has been taken on with a huge extravagance, and obviously a lot of people have profited from that, but a much larger number have not. Now, I think that the process of political adjustment to and comprehension of what's gone on is really only beginning. We're coming up pretty soon on a year from the credit problems that began with such flair back last August. And I think that the administration in the United States, but other people elsewhere too, have taken a lot of pain and a lot of effort to make this look like a less important set of disruptions than it is, and hoping to keep the debate from gelling too much. But I think we're in the midst of something really quite substantial and quite unfortunate.
But when you say, Kevin Phillips, that the disparity of wealth then is worse than the rest of the world, a lot of that has been always the case because you've had tyranny and disproportion and lack of democracy and no middle class in so much of the world. But we've always been considered here in the United States as the sort of the bastion of the middle class. The American dream is built around the middle class. And it seems to me that that is really the greatest indictment of these last few years, surely, is the dissipation of the middle class.
Well, I think that's right. There's a much greater danger, I think, for the country in the unraveling of the middle class than of the problems and the unfairness hitting people in perhaps the lowest quarter or 30% of the population, simply because the role of the United States in American history makes its potential disillusionment and in maltreatment, which we have seen, much more incendiary. Now, I think that you've had so far, and it's not just this administration, it really goes back two decades, and the bubble during the Clinton years, which really fed a lot of wealth maldistribution, too, because of its effect on stocks and then the tech fortunes, is part of it. It's something much more complex than has been discussed. The plight of the middle class is important. Part of the difficulty is the middle class doesn't entirely know its own plight.
Well, I think some people are waking up to the fact that their homes are worth less than they owe, and surely they're waking up every time they go to the gas pump, how bad it is, and how it's all happened all of a sudden, hasn't it? I mean, it's not, there's some sticker shock going on here.
Well, the big upheaval, what's drawn attention, has been in the last year, maybe even the last half year. But it certainly goes back a good bit further. Now, when I talk about the problems that hit the middle class not being entirely obvious to the middle class, what I mean is this. Sure, you can see the problems with inflation writ large and gas prices and what's happening in the grocery stores and supermarkets. But what's happened more importantly is that for, a good decade now, you've had changes made that build up slowly but then hit their overdrive, so to speak, about 10 years ago. In terms of statistics, both about inflation and about the growth of the economy, that have really disguised what's been happening. The average family thinks that inflation is somewhere in the 5 to 7, maybe even 9% range. The government insists it's only 2%. And they try to use core inflation and pretend that what happens in energy and food doesn't matter. As a result of relying on statistics like that, all kinds of government programs and measurements have shortchanged a lot of people in terms of hiding how much of an inroad inflation is made in their wage scales, in their pensions, in a whole host of things. Well, not least, for example, the pittance that people get as interest in banks or even in certificates of deposit relative to what the real inflation rate is. And because a lot of Americans don't fully understand this, the government relentlessly denies it and the press doesn't discuss it much, they actually think they're better off than they are. I'm reasonably convinced if you used fair inflation numbers that the gross domestic product would not have grown in the last quarter, but would have contracted. And, of course, the psychological impact of that on believing what the government said about the economy would have been enormous. But it's part of the way in which the debate is fuddled and confused and distorted.
And what's happening, though, in terms of our overall kind of ethic, if you will, not just the work ethic, but when you think back at the robber barons, and many people think that have argued that this we're revisiting the Gilded Age with George W. Bush, but the difference is that the titans of industry, the Carnegies and people, the Rockefellers, etc., and the Henry Fords, they actually produced something. It seems to me that the people that we admire, and I noticed a piece recently on 60 Minutes, a Valentine to Carl Icahn, who's a speculator. He doesn't bring anything to the table. It seems to me that now we're sort of in an economy that admires people who make bets rather than people who produce things.
Oh, I think that's right. I think that's part of the upheaval that's occurred. For example, if you went back and looked at the numbers in the 1970s, Manufacturing accounted for 25% to 27% of what was then the gross national product, and the financial services only 10% to 12%. Now financial services are the plurality, 20% to 21%, and manufacturing shrunk down to 12%. As part of the rise of finance, we've glorified money. We've made a money culture into a money-worshipping culture. And then secondly, the rise of finance has included the rise of a huge debt and credit industry. And we've seen this growing very, very vividly for the last 25 years. Debt of all kinds of varieties, whether it be mortgage or credit card or other sorts of household debt like auto loans, or the huge amounts of borrowed money that circulate in all these financial deals and are wagered by investment banks as if they were part of Las Vegas. This has taken over a lot of society, and people who aren't part of it can't begin to make anything like the money that people make who are part of it.
And obviously the subprime meltdown is a perfect example of that, because those instruments that they created are worthless now, but they managed to create some kind of weird financial alchemy where these so-called ninja loans, no income, job, and assets, were suddenly AAA gold-plated. The guys that sold them all got their fees, and they spread them out around the world. I guess to some extent it wasn't an entirely an American disaster, thanks to the willingness or the gullibility of foreign banks. But at the end of the day, people are dropping out of the middle class. As you know, those that strive to get in to the middle class are the real victims. And it seems to me, again, it gets back to my first question, is there an accounting on this that massive transfer of wealth from poor, striving people who wanted to join the middle class to these characters on Wall Street?
Well, is there an accounting coming? Yeah, to a small extent. You can see that attorney generals and then local enforcement people have raised these issues in a lot of places, and they're pointing their fingers at the not just the mortgage lenders, but at some of Wall Street. But the opposition party in the United States is the Democratic Party, and the Republicans, who basically have been closest to the financial sector, are now finding that the financial sector is directing the great percentage, I mean, a solid majority of its contributions to the Democrats. I'm talking about the federal level, not state.
Mm-hmm.
And the upshot, I think, is to try to increase their influence there. It's already been pretty considerable. So I'm not sure what kind of comeuppance is coming, but just let me take the subprime thing as an example of how there's much more to this than the average family knows. The mortgage lenders who came up with all of these gimmicky-type mortgages, whether they be subprime or interest-only or adjustable rate or, you know, 8 or 10 other flavors, all of which promised you know, everything's nice now and you may not have to pay for a couple of years, and by that time you'll have gotten rid of it because you'll have made 25% by reselling your house, all of this sort of stuff. It was a con job. But part of the way in which it was a con job was that the mortgage lenders who were making these loans to people who really couldn't afford any normal loan knew that as soon as they made them, they could sell them again, because Wall Street had a new gimmick, which was essentially mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, and what they called collateralized debt obligations. And these were basically agglomerations, packagings, of anywhere from 100 to 5,000 or even more loans in a large package, which was then assembled and rated as to different parts of it with these hugely overblown ratings, and then sold around the world. So not only did the mortgage lenders make their pile out of the sucker bait mortgages, but then they sold them to people who basically repackaged them and made another big pile of money, and the repackaging into something that was worth maybe $1 million, maybe $53 million, maybe even more. They were sold to financial institutions around the world. Nobody knows exactly where some of these loans wound up, so the whole thing has been called into question. It's sleazy, it was enormously profitable, and the average American doesn't understand what happened yet.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. What role, though, in this, and of course, just Sunday's New York Times lead editorial suggests that there's worse to come, that the bad lending bubble will continue to wreak havoc on our economy, that neither the president nor the Congress have an effective plan, and in doing nothing, it's bound to get a lot worse. But it seems to me that, again, the notion of trying to get a macro view of what happened to create this crisis in American capitalism, yeah, I get the feeling that in many ways the beginning of the Bush administration was the beginning of Enron's raid on California. That $30 billion that they stole from California was entirely enabled by their cronyism connected to the administration, and the mechanism by which they were able to plunder the state of California was by stopping the regulatory authorities from doing their job, or putting the fox in charge of the hen house, if you will. And it seems that we're sort of going a full circle here, because the same mechanism took place with the subprime. So it's not sort of – are we in an age where we're not talking about business done on an even playing field, but it's about plunder enabled by cronyism?
Well, part of what I tried to explain in Bad Money is to take the whole genesis of this change and crisis back 20 or 25 years, and to show how the money involved has grown, how the deregulation has grown, about how the statistics have been perverted, whether it be the ratings or the the surveys of what's happened in the economy. I don't think there was a conspiracy that people carried out that was defined 15, 20, or 25 years ago. It was just convenient and made a lot of money. And the people who were really calling the shots in the financial sector had a huge amount of influence in politics in both parties. And yes, the gestation was the most vivid in the Bush administration, partly because you had this huge amount of attempt to get people to borrow in order to get the economy back on its feet without doing any harm to the people with all the money who got tax cuts. But to get the economy back on its feet through the labors of the average person after 9/11, and they chose, in essence, the housing bubble as the gimmick, knowing that there had to be something to pick up on the money that was lost in the stock market and tech market bubble. And this is something that, you know, people know, but they don't know enough about it. And the administration doesn't want to discuss it. You'll never hear all the information as to the changes in which sector had what part of GDP. You'll never hear the statistics as to the huge amount of private loans that were developed and profiteered so nicely. But Congress has gotten so much money from these people that, you know, they're collaborative, too. They're collaborating in the bailouts, and there are Democrats in Congress who are as happy with the bailouts as Republicans.
Sure, and there, several of them are running for the hills from their countrywide loans at the moment.
Yes.
So, no, this is a bipartisan disaster. But I remember a few months ago when things were starting to really unwind in the housing market, talking to the economist Jamie Galbraith, and he rattled off a whole list of things that could be done to stop the hemorrhaging just as it was starting. But then he finished the statement by saying, but of course it's not going to get done. What is it about our government that, what you're implying, Kevin Phillips, is that they don't do anything about it because they're compromised?
Yes, I think they're compromised. Jamie Galbraith is an advisor of sorts now in the new shakeup in the Obama group of economists, and he'll provide a useful, broader view, but I kind of suspect that the people who are critics of what's gone on will be like Bob Reich was in the Clinton administration, outmaneuvered behind the scenes by the Wall Street crowd. The power of money is such that I really don't believe Washington will do anything that is too much against their interest group and political donor connections.
But would the explanation for why so much Wall Street money is going Obama's way, is it that they really believe in him, or that they think he's going to win?
Oh, they think he's going to win, or they think the Democrats are going to win. And they sense quite rightly that Obama has the sort of education that makes him open to the, certainly at least to the arguments, and the so many of the people he knew in law school would be on the part of the financial system at this point. So I think that their interest in him is more self-centered than it is an agreement or a hope that any reforms he has in mind were to be implemented. But it takes two to tango, and nobody who's running for high office can afford to just wish away the money that these people have, and that's their asset.
So there's a kind of diminishing or a sort of vortex that happens here, because as the foreclosure crisis, and it's obviously going to be dumped on the next administration, it continues to compound other parts of the economy, and it has the effect of dragging everything down, doesn't it, surely?
Well, it's certainly part of what's dragging everything down, but I can tell you there's another huge mistake that was made especially by the Republicans, but again, it was bipartisan. That's not to pay enough attention to the changes that were developing in the oil markets. When the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, part of the blueprint was really to get a hold of Iraqi oil and use that to, if they could, flood the market so as to drive down the price of oil, and they hoped bust OPEC. Now, because the administration was so inept and really couldn't do anything right, they offended the OPEC people and the Persian Gulf oil powers, from the Saudis to a whole lot of the Emirates and Sheikhdoms. And so as a result, slowly but surely, OPEC was perfectly happy to let the price rise really five or six-fold, from $20 to $25 a barrel in 2003 up to $120 to $125, or maybe now $130 to $135 in 2008. But part of the argument that's made is that the change in the oil price, in a lot of ways, bears relation to the expansion of the money supply measured by a yardstick that the Bush administration got rid of in 2006, called M3, which really looks at the loans in the financial system, to somewhat oversimplify it. And if you correlate M3, the huge expansion of the money supply as measured by a broad yardstick that includes the expansion of a banking and financial system credit, then all you have is the oil price is keeping up with the expansion of the essentially financial system money supply under M3. Now, what that would mean is that in a large measure, the rise in the price of oil is the consequence of the huge expansion of the money supply and the desire on the part of, well, people in the oil business, but also people in finance and investors, to try to keep well ahead of inflation by investing in something that's a more solid asset than a U.S. dollar, which is linked to the failures of American financial policy and the greed of Wall Street and the massive expansion of debt and the further expansion of debt that's coming down the pike in the next 15 years from Medicare and Social Security and the entitlements. So in some respects, the failure of what's been going on in this country for the last decade, and especially the last 8 years, is also part of the rise of the price of oil. And, of course, the politicians now are desperate to blame that on something other than a partial root in America's own economic behavior.
So not only do we have the pain from ruined families being foreclosed on and house values declining below their what people owe, and which of course affects local tax revenues, and it has the spiraling effect of reducing government revenues and continues to make credit tight. You're suggesting here, just in the closing minutes here, Kevin Phillips, that in effect, this almost oil's become almost a substitute currency, if it will. And I get the figures are pretty alarming of how much money is pouring into the commodities market in the last year or so. And I guess if you're a rich Saudi and you're making all this money and it's denominated in dollars, you might as well game your own market, right?
Well, I think that's right. But if you look, for example, in California, a lot of the places that are being hurt the most by the housing crisis and the decline in housing values and prices, they're also areas that are not the older suburbs. They're the newer suburbs that are further out on the interstates because of the burden that people had to go further out, and they had to get housing in new areas like Stockton, which is the classic, well outside of San Francisco. And as a result, you're getting people who are being clobbered by the real estate crisis, and a lot of them are also being clobbered living in these remote subdivisions and everything by the gasoline crisis.
Because they commute 2 hours a day.
Yes, exactly.
About sometimes an hour in gridlock.
Exactly. And if politicians were free to tell the truth, it would be, I think, an incredible revelation to a lot of those people. Mm. But even people who would like to tell the truth are aware that their own side has been involved in some of the games, so they're not quite as free. And I'm not happy at all about this election. As far as I'm concerned, the circumstances I've laid out in my book are things that the power structure simply does not want to discuss, because there is no convenient answer that's acceptable to the big contributors in Wall Street. And they're not going to do anything that's not acceptable to those people.
Well, just in closing, Kevin Phillips, what do you think the effect of the Saudis increasing production? I mean, Dick Cheney went there a few months ago and asked them to help out the Republicans in the forthcoming election, and they basically told him to get lost. They said, you you guys are just another customer. But something seems to have happened. Is this the Saudis themselves have figured they got to do something because this is going to probably push people into alternatives?
Well, to try to get through it quickly, I think the nubbin is that the Saudis don't want to do very much because they don't want to pump any more oil than they have to. They know it's a resource that's gaining value, and they don't want to give it away lightly. They want to keep it for themselves and space it out. But I think mostly what they're talking about is there's another big field which they have been developing for 5 or 10 years, and they've been talking about starting to tap that. Now, I think they probably included it in their previous estimates, but they're talking about bringing some of that oil into production for the first time. Now, this is, if you watch the Saudis pretty closely, often much less than meets the eye, because the pea that they're pointing to when this walnut shell has been lifted was a pea they discussed before. So I'm not sure what's there, but I do know the Saudis don't want to be made the scapegoat, and they probably want to throw the Pentagon a little bit of something. A lot of people in the military services, and they're awfully important to Saudi Arabia, are really worried what's coming down the pike with oil and its scarcity and its price. So they may do something. They won't do much. Doing too much is against their interest, the same way just sitting there and thumbing their fingers at the United States would be against their interest. But we no longer command the power over there that we did 2 years ago, to say nothing of 5 years ago.
Mm. And I think that a lot of that has to do with George W. I think they're disgusted by him and what he's done. That's what I hear.
I think they think he's a second-rater. They know how much of his family got deals and benefits and corporate connections from the Persian Gulf Emirates and Kuwait and elsewhere and from the Saudis. and they would have their own private views of George W.'s depth and capacity, and I doubt that they're very flattering.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Kevin Phillips, and for your book, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Again, I thank you so much for it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer, and a special thanks for production assistant today. Thank you, Walter Douglas and Stan Mizrahi. ¶¶